Live on DAZN Worldwide, May 2nd and 3rd, Garcia versus Romero and Canelo versus Skull. Friday from 6 p.m. Eastern, Garcia returns in a history-making Times Square takeover. 24 hours later, Saturday from 7 p.m. Eastern, King Canelo faces undefeated Skull for the undisputed crown. May 2nd and 3rd, a knockout weekend of boxing. Pick one or go all in for only $90, exclusively on DAZN. Buy now at DAZN.com/boxing.
When you golf in Missouri, the courses are so close, you'll spend more time on the fairway than the freeway. Reserve a tee time at the Regal Osage National, designed by the king himself, Arnold Palmer. Take a cart ride on the wild side in the breathtaking surrounds of Payne's Valley, designed by Tiger Woods. And after the back nine, there's still world-class dining and distilleries, shops and spas, museums and more. Find your new golf MO in Missouri. Start planning your golf getaway at visitmo.com.
All right, everyone, welcome back to another episode of Friends from Work. This is a podcast about all things in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and it's hosted by me, Kyle Sconewill, and my longtime friend, Robbie Earle. Robbie, welcome to Friends from Work. How are you today?
Man, I am good. I love being back on an episode of Friends from Work. It's like a safe space.
That's like our running joke now, 3 weeks in a row, I think, which I love.
When all else is unpredictable craziness, as life has been lately, there's always Friends from Work, you know?
Robbie just told me off air before we started this that you always tell me you're busy, but you said, this is probably the busiest I have ever been in my life, hands down. So that's the context of today's episode. And yet he's making time for little old me, which I love so much.
Oh, man. Well, there's a lot of fun stuff to make time for today.
So today is extra special because we got a chance to talk with John Paisano, who, if you don't know who that is, you probably haven't been listening to our podcast for very long, and that's okay. But the reason we're talking to him today is because of not only his work on Daredevil, not only his work on Miles Morales' video game, but also his work on the Spider-Man PS4 video game, which everyone on this podcast knows how obsessed we are with that game. So it was an absolute, absolute pleasure. And so, Robbie, today, if you don't mind, I quickly just want to knock out a few what's new in the MCU things here, a few important housekeeping things for our listeners before we dive into that interview.
Yeah, let's hit it.
So, as you know, this is a big week for Marvel. On Tuesday, a couple days ago, if you're listening to this on Thursday, Spider-Man No Way Home officially came out available for purchase digitally. So, congratulations. You can't rent it, I don't think yet, but you can buy it. I'll have to test it soon.
Well, and, you know, I'm really glad that this all came together. We've been working closely with Sony on this, and we were originally, you know, we had decided together that the film was going to come out next week. And we were, as part of our Saga So Far rewatch, again, of course, we've been kind of in conversations with Sony and Amy Pascal.
And she was like, can we just do it a little bit earlier?
Right. And we pushed back initially and they were like, oh, well, you know, totally up to y'all. But then we gave in and they decided to put it out a week earlier. And, you know, we decided that we would have our Saga So Far, Spider-Man No Way Home rewatch party a week earlier. So
wow,
this is an exciting day in a lot of ways, Kyle, because not only do we get to talk about John Paisano's excellent Spider-Man music, not only do we get to announce that we're having our Loki rewatch on Thursday night like we have been, but we get to announce that Friday, the day after our Loki rewatch, right after the multiverse opens wide, we're going to get to watch Spider-Man No Way Home for the first time in our living rooms as a Friends from Work community. So if you are listening to this and you have not watched No Way Home yet, hold off one more day because we're going to have a lot of fun watching that tomorrow as a Friends from Work crew.
Well, I'm glad Sony was willing to be flexible on that. How nice of them.
They're great.
Just to make sure we're not confusing anyone, Tuesday, Spider-Man No Way Home was available digitally. Wednesday was the first day that Daredevil and a few of the other Marvel Netflix shows came to Disney Plus, which is kind of a crazy thing for Disney Plus. There's been a little bit of pushback on how graphic the content is being on Disney Plus, but it's kind of a new era in that way, bringing that over. And so if you've been listening along to our Daredevil breakdowns on Friends from Work Plus, or just listening to us reference it so much, you can now watch it on Disney Plus as of yesterday. But then not only that, Robbie, then you have today, Thursday, this episode where we talked with John Pisano about his work on Daredevil. Tonight, then, we're watching Loki finale together.
Yep.
FFW saga so far. And then tomorrow is Spider-Man No Way Home, FFW saga so far. So, yikes. Perfect week to add to Robbie's busyness.
I should say also, while we're talking about the saga so far rewatch, we have a winner to announce for last week's Eternals rewatch, which
let's do it.
Was a lot of fun. And I want to talk about it in a quick second after this. But our winner of the first volume of Kieran Gillen and Asad Ribic's, I think I'm saying that correctly, Eternals comic, which is incredible, by the way. I don't often recommend ongoing runs for characters because it's sometimes kind of hard to gauge. But this one is really, really excellent. Kieran Gillen's one of the more interesting comics writers out there, and Ribic is maybe one of my favorite artists. So I'm excited about this, excited that we get to give this volume to Twitter user Universal Inhuman.
Okay.
Don't have a full name. That's his handle. Gave some great commentary the other night. Was one of the many folks that joined in. So that's the name we pulled out of our collective Friends from Work hat. If you are listening, reach out to us or we will direct message you shortly and get you the comic that you've won. So congrats.
Let's go. That's so much fun.
It is fun.
So just to keep people up to date here, we are almost all the way through rewatching all of Phase 4. We've done WandaVision. We've done Falcon and the Winter Soldier. We did Spider-Man Far From Home, Shang-Chi, Eternals last week. And then as Robbie said, it's Loki tonight. It's No Way Home tomorrow night. And then Hawkeye next week. And then we'll be caught up just in time for Moon Knight, which I'm bringing that up, Robbie, because... To add to the craziness of the week, your boys, Robbie and Kyle, Friends from Work, are getting to see a few of the episodes of Moon Knight this week. So come next week, we will have seen those episodes, and we're going to give you a little preview, spoiler-free, of course, on what our initial reaction to those episodes was. Not to mention, we're also attending the press conference next week, so we'll have a little more background info. I always enjoy doing that, hearing from the actors, getting a chance to ask them some questions to help inform our Moon Knight experience. What I've been hearing is very positive thus far.
Man, I'm as excited for this show as I think I've been for a Disney Plus show, which it sounds kind of crazy. I mean, there was a lot of buzz for WandaVision. It's hard to separate out the buzz for WandaVision before it came out from just, oh, we're getting new MCU content. And then obviously once WandaVision came, as we've said kind of ad nauseum, it was incredible. But even like the really high points with Loki and as much as I loved parts of Hawkeye, like I don't think I've been this excited, period, yet. I'm just, this show is like really getting me revved up.
So what a week. Once we see that, man, we're only a week away from launching into weekly coverage of that show. And then once we start that, I'm pretty sure we're going to dive right into Doctor Strange stuff mixed in there as well. So it's going to be crazy. And I think there's actually a few fun things we can do with Moon Knight, because unlike Spider-Man, unlike Hawkeye, unlike even WandaVision, Moon Knight is a character that we both don't know as much about. You're catching up on the comic side of things. And I know literally nothing. Literally nothing. Right. It's like Daredevil all over again. So I think it's going to be a fun perspective for people because it's a fresh entry into the MCU for us. So we can really reflect on who is Moon Knight as a character in the comics. And that will be my first time hearing it. And we can really reflect on, well, who are they portraying Moon Knight to be in the show as well? So I'm with you. Well, I'm really looking forward to it.
I think what's going to be so interesting about that, to piggyback on what you just said, is the normal, I'm not going to say this is across the board consistent, but I would say the standard comics character, when you ask who is this in the comics, you can kind of look back to their origin and pretty easily sum up who this person is. Like Spider-Man, you can hand someone Amazing Fantasy 15 and they come away with a pretty good understanding of who the Spider-Man character is, to where if they just read that comic and then watched any Spider-Man film, they would kind of get the translation. But I think what's interesting about Moon Knight is the character has changed so much under different writers and artists over the years, like really changed in a way that I think allows this creative team on the show, including Oscar Isaac, because everything I've read, everything I've heard really suggests that he has gone headfirst into the weeds with this, like really worked out exactly what he wants the character to be. So I think he can take this really fragmented comics history and maybe more so than with any other character, pull what he wants, leave what he doesn't. You know, obviously the rest, not saying that's all Oscar Isaac, but I think that it just creates a really unique kind of like artistic launching pad, I think.
Right.
You know, without trying to overstate it.
And that's one of the things I can't actually wait to hear from him directly at the press conference, honestly. I'm excited to hear what he pulled from to develop that character. Two last bits of news here, two last things of what's new in the MCU. William Hurt, director Thaddeus Ross, passed away this week.
Man.
He died on Sunday of this week, I think, of cancer, Robbie. Which is just too bad. It's sad. Someone shared his reel, and obviously he's an award-winning actor that's been in a ton of movies, but at this point he's been in like 6 or 7 MCU entries, which is pretty wild. So
yeah,
he died at age 71. Whenever someone dies, it's always kind of weird because there's the loss of the actor, but also the loss of the character. And as far as I know, the last time we left director Ross was in Infinity War when he tells Captain America to turn himself in, I think, right? That's the last. I know we saw him in Black Widow, but that was in the MCU timeline earlier on.
I think he showed up at Tony Stark's funeral in Endgame.
Oh, correct. You are so right. He is there for sure. So it'll be interesting to see how they address that now in the films. And I should also say that it is very sad anytime you lose a life. I know that since he's passed, some stories have resurfaced about him being abusive, I think, to his wife or his ex-wife. And so I don't know anything about his personal character. And so that's always a weird, you know, that's always a weird spot to be in, you know?
Right.
Because you are mourning the loss of an actor, but I don't know him as a person at all.
Sure. But no, that was definitely a blow this week. William Hurt had a prolific career and a very impressive career as an actor. So if nothing else, that's a loss to the film industry.
Well, and then Robbie, my last bit of business here before we hear from John, which was such a good conversation. I can't wait for you to hear it. I have one leftover from our Batman episode last Thursday, and this is totally spoiler free. So this has nothing to do with the plot. So you don't have to turn this off if you haven't seen the Batman. But Robbie, I think I forgot to give Matt Reeves the credit he deserves. And this is totally just my fault. I posted a story about this on TikTok at the FFW podcast and on Instagram at the FFW podcast. But dude, for some reason, this just slipped my mind. I Googled Matt Reeves and I did not realize some of the films he's worked on. And that's, again, totally my bad. And I don't know how I missed that. But he did the last two Planet of the Apes films. And
yeah, man,
he was a producer on 10 Cloverfield Lane. So he didn't direct that movie, but that's in my top 15 favorite of all time. I was just going over this with some friends and I was like, how did I not know that he was involved in that? I know he was also involved in the first Cloverfield, which was so unique at the time and how they marketed it and everything. And those last two Planet of the Apes movies are no joke, guys. Like if you think I'm being funny, dude, the reboot of the Planet of the Apes is awesome in my opinion.
Dude, that trilogy is excellent.
So between him working on that trilogy, him working on the Cloverfield stuff, man, he's getting on my short list of directors that I'm going to look at every time he puts a movie out now. Like, he's on that shorter list, and that's my bad for not bringing that up in the episode.
Well, and I mentioned this on the Slack, but Planet of the Apes, also a powerhouse Matt Reeves-Andy Serkis combo.
Oh, yeah.
Because Andy Serkis did the mocap for the main ape, if you will, in Planet of the Apes.
Caesar. Apes together. Strong. Caesar. Yes. Dude, some good movies there. So,
Kyle's Movie Club, question mark?
Oh, might have to. I need the next film in the movie club to be a donut a little bit more. I think I'm ready for a lighthearted one just because we've done Parasite and Arrival, and now it's time to like lighten it up a little bit. So maybe I need to start making a list of these directors that I'm really into. I know a lot of our listeners know a few of those names on the list already, but there's a few other names where I'm like, okay, you've made like three or four pretty legit movies. It's time for Kyle to be paying attention. So, okay. But
yeah,
today is extra special because, as I said, we got a chance to talk with John Paisano. And boy, like I said, if you've been listening to this podcast, you know that I'm a fan of what he's done with Daredevil and both of the Spider-Man video games. And you and I have talked on this podcast about how do we get him into the MCU. It's time for him to get a crack at one of these Marvel movies. And so I actually ask him about that a little bit coming up here. So I think you're going to really enjoy this conversation, even if you're not into the music side of things, because he gives us a few interesting tidbits about the process of making Daredevil and the process of Daredevil coming over to Disney Plus and what that looks like. And maybe even a few tidbits on what he's doing with Spider-Man 2. Oh,
ooh, man.
So I think you're going to enjoy this conversation after a quick word from these sponsors. All right, everyone, please welcome to Friends from Work, composer extraordinaire, John Paisano. John, welcome. Let's go.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
What an honor this is. If you scoured our podcast, John, you mm-hmm. would find that you are not going to find bigger fans of what you do than us do right here. So this is truly a dream come true. So thank you.
Awesome. No, thank you. I appreciate it.
I should clarify, Kyle and I started this podcast in 2019, and we started out talking exclusively about the MCU. The first episode we ever did not about the MCU was Kyle raving about the Spider-Man PS4 video game, specifically raving about your score for the Spider-Man PS4 video game. So this is a long time coming. Very, very excited to have you here.
Well, John, here's where I want to start with Daredevil. Yeah. Because as of yesterday, Daredevil is officially on Disney Plus.
Yeah,
so I need you to kind of rewind here. Take me back to 2015, 2014, where you were at when you got that project, and specifically what went through your head crafting that theme.
Well, the theme was actually developed as a demo that I had done. So the initial showrunner on Daredevil season one was a guy named Stephen Tonight, who I'd done a lot mm-hmm. of work with before. We had worked on kind of some proof of concept stuff that he was working on, and so we kind of made a relationship that way. And Daredevil was something that he kind of signed on to do. And you know, it was at that point, I really hadn't done a ton of stuff. You know, I want to say it was before Maze Runner. I think the only thing I was really kind of doing at the time was I was doing a How to Train Your Dragon series for Cartoon Network. So it was like one of my earlier projects. And I had been in the business for a while, kind of in the shadows, doing support work for a lot of other composers around town, things of that nature. And the opportunity came up and I was like, hey, Steven, I'd love to throw my hat in the ring for this. And there was kind of a auditioning process that went along with it, where it was, you know, they kind of had like a short list of, you know, four or five composers. And one of the scenes that we had to write to was that kind of infamous hallway fight sequence that lasted for.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And it wasn't, if I remember correctly, I don't think it was the whole fight sequence, but it was part of it. And that the actual Daredevil theme was kind of originated out of that sequence. And it kind of got me the gig. So it actually worked out really well. But yeah, it was a tricky show just because it was kind of the first Marvel show that they had done where they kind of broke that mold, you know, like Marvel mm-hmm. was always I don't want to say safe, but it was exactly what you kind of thought it was going to be. It was bright. It was happy. It was fun. It, you know, always with, you know, a lot of comedy kind of involved with it. And then here came the show that was a lot more grounded. It was dark. It had a lot more edge to it than most of the other Marvel properties. And I think, you know, it definitely kind of, I think it stuck out. You know, you throw that Marvel logo on something and then you had a show like that, which it felt, you know, a lot darker. And I think that really kind of gave it its own voice in that universe. So it was a real kind of fun show to be part of, just because Marvel and Netflix kind of worked together on that show. And they allowed like all the creatives working on it to really kind of put our own stamp on it. So it was a lot of fun to work on those kind of initial phases of that show.
Is it kind of exciting for you to watch this show have a second life a little bit now?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's funny. I mean, it's just being, it's such a popular show, you know, and even though it's hasn't been on, you know, quote unquote, you know, it hasn't been in production for the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. It's still amazing how many new fans kind of come out of the woodwork, and I'll get pinged all the time from people saying how much they love the show or how much they love the score. And I feel like it's kind of had, it's had a long life, even though it hasn't necessarily been in production for a couple of years now. And it was fun too, because every single season that we did, they kind of brought in like a new creative team to a degree. Mm-hmm. And each season has its kind of own identity, and obviously the main characters kind of kept the storyline kind of somewhat glued together, but the shows definitely did have different feels to it, you know. So season one was its own thing, season two had definitely a different feel to it, and then season three had its, and listen, like that show would keep going today, but I think there was just with Netflix and Disney starting their own thing and then right. wanting to kind of pull their IP, you know, off of, you know, I don't know, pull it off of Netflix, but they wanted to kind of, you know, bring their own IP into their own world as far as like a streaming situation went. I think that's honestly the only reason why we kind of lost production on that show, just because it was all contractual and politics. Right. So it was definitely I think that show would still be, you know, going strong today if it wasn't for all that. So it was kind of a casualty of the business.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I watched every season as it came out, and Kyle actually just recently got to go back and watch the show.
Yeah.
And after season three, I told him, I was like, now imagine that came out and then immediately the show gets canceled, and how just enraged you would be. And you can put yourself in my position.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I think a lot of the fans definitely, it was like a gut punch, you know?
Right.
It's funny. I had a lot of projects that were kind of wrapped up in that whole, you know, there was a lot, you know, the business kind of went through this massive change in the last couple of years. And obviously with COVID, it was kind of the business was already changing a lot. And then COVID came and it was kind of like an accelerator of stuff that was already changing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was doing a film with my director that I worked with on all the Maze Runner stuff, Wes Ball. And we were working on a film called Mouse Guard. And it was this really mm-hmm. incredible animated, you know, mocap film that, you know, had a great cast, really, really cool story. We were like a week away from production and the plug got pulled on it because Disney just didn't want to, you know, when they purchased Fox, it was originally with Fox. And then when Disney bought 20th Century Fox, and they kind of shelved it. But there is a lot of projects, not just stuff that I worked on, but it's amazing how many projects got kind of like, you know, casualties of the business just kind of turning upside down from a distribution standpoint. And there's kind of like been a great realignment. And I think in the long run, it's going to be a good thing, just because there's all these studios and all these channels and all these subscription-based services, they just need so much content. So there's a lot of cool stuff being created, but there was a lot of casualties as well, like when that was happening. So Daredevil, to a degree, I think fell victim to a little bit of that kind of change in the atmosphere.
Talking specifically about the music nitty gritty here. Yeah. I love the last track on season one of Daredevil, where you take the main title theme, but it's the mm-hmm. first time you kind of change a few of the chords. It's got the orchestra instead.
Yeah.
Take a little bit. Just first of all, just compliment you, but then just tell me a little bit about it. I need to hear more.
Well, we wanted, you know, we like the main title, you know, the tough thing about main titles is they're so short, you know what I mean? And you kind of,
yes,
you kind of get a relatively short amount of time to kind of express it. So I felt mm-hmm. like, I want to say, I can't remember now, but I think it was the last episode. We wanted to kind of take the main title and kind of shoot it up with steroids, you know, and give it kind of more of a bigger cinematic approach. Whereas like the original main title was definitely a little darker, a little more subdued, a little more, you know, it kind of oozed, you know, is like the word that I'll use mystery. For it. Yeah. You know, it was just and when you look at the, I mean, it was written obviously for the visuals that you're seeing for the main title, you know, and it was so specific to that. And so we kind of wanted to juice it up a little bit, and it was fun to kind of, you know, infuse a little bit more of that orchestral sound into it and kind of give it some size.
Well, what a cool moment it is, by the way.
Yeah, cool. No, season three was awesome. I mean, season three was really, you know, Eric Olson, who was the showrunner on it, mm-hmm. like really did a good job of like, you know, taking that storyline. But I think he definitely like viewed it more as like almost like an espionage thriller, you know, mm-hmm. versus like a superhero,
yeah.
you know, property. And so like he really pushed everybody to kind of, you know, let's try to be as like, you know, as smart and witty as we could with a lot of the stuff. So there's a lot, I mean, there's cues in episode three that are very filmic, you know, and they're not as, you know, they're almost more drama. It's almost more drama mm-hmm. than it is superhero, you know? And so it was fun to really kind of reinvent the palette a little bit for that season. And you know, it was great. We recorded all those series. We did it all live. We did it right. You know, we did it, you know, nothing was really in the box. We were able to really, you know, hire live musicians and player, you know, and just kind of do it, give it kind of like a proper film score. And I think it really shows on screen.
Well, as John can see on video here, I've got my various John Paisano vinyl collection, which includes the Defenders music, which I am a huge fan of your score there. And
yeah.
I think that can often get lost because, you know, I think Daredevil is generally known as a better received show. And I just don't think people pay a lot of attention to Defenders in the same way. But I find myself, it's so funny, the reason I have all these scores is I'm a lawyer by day and write briefs to music, to film and TV music. And I find the ones that I gravitate towards the most are your Defender score and the Miles Morales score, which we'll talk about at the end of the episode. So I just wanted, before we lost the Netflix thread, to let you know that I'm a really, really big fan of what you did there as well.
Yeah, no, Defenders was the thing that was so tricky about Defenders was we had all those characters and they obviously each had a musical identity to them. But because the nature of the show, it was so hard to kind of, oh, let's, you know, we'll jam Jessica Jones theme in here and then we'll jam the Daredevil theme in here. And then, mm-hmm. you know, we'll deal with the Luke Cage theme here. I mean, you just couldn't, it was too chaotic. So we tried to figure out a way to kind of score them as a group versus kind of scoring them each individually, if that makes sense. I mean, it would just, yeah, it's very easy to kind of get that, you know, you can kind of get themeitis where you're just overusing themes so much that it all of a sudden, it just starts sounding like random music. You know what I mean? And there's no kind of single through line that's connecting all these characters. So we really, you know, the idea was we really wanted to try to aim to kind of give them their own sound and kind of give them their own world. And it was a creative choice to, you know, one of like the first things we had to decide to do was, God, how do we want to handle, you know, all these different characters that they all had strong themes and they all had strong musical scores. Mm-hmm. But how do we, you know, we tried to kind of tip the cap to some of them, but it was just, we kind of made the conscious choice to like, but instead of just trying to incorporate everyone's theme all the time, let's just try to create our own score for this story kind of being told with all these characters versus let's just, you know, write, you know, use their themes when they're on screen type of thing. So it was a cool approach. And I think it worked out well, but again, it was like, you know, credit to Marvel and Netflix. They really let us approach these scores like they were you know, like they were films and not, and then you got to remember too, like this is before Mandalorian and before these big, you know, episodic right. Winter Soldier and stuff. Like it was, you know, to get a live score on an episodic series like this is it's a little bit of a challenge politically, you know, to try to
sure.
get people to sign off on this stuff and to get people to, it's expensive, you know, it's expensive. It takes planning and commitment, and studios, you know, generally want to have a lot of control over scores and have, you know, want to give a lot of notes and changes. And when you do a live score, you have to kind of commit and say like, okay, well, this is what we're going to be recording and that's it, you know? So,
right.
So it was cool. And I think it shows in the music.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Shifting gears a teeny bit here.
Yeah.
What is different for you, for a composer, between writing something for film TV, like you're talking about, and a video game?
That's a good question. I, you know, it's interesting. I personally think that writing music for video games is more of a, it's more of a old school approach, believe it or not, than writing for film. And I'll give you my reasons why. When you're writing music for video games, you're not necessarily writing the picture. You know, you're kind of writing at the same time as they're building the game. So it's not like, you know, with film and, you know, you usually start off, I mean, I try never really honestly to start off writing to picture, and that's a bigger conversation. And it kind of goes to what I'm about to say about how writing for video games is different. When you're, like I said, when you're writing to video games, you aren't necessarily working with picture. You're writing based off of creative briefs. You're writing based off of artwork, story, obviously, and you basically write suites to begin. You know, you say like, okay, well, we have this character, Peter Parker. He's a little bit more, you know, this is like, I'll talk with, you know, the director, Brian, about Spider-Man 1. He'll say like, you know, we have Peter Parker. He's a little bit more aged up. He's not like a high school Peter Parker. He's a little more edgy. He's blah, blah. You know, he gives me all these kind of bullet points about the character. And he'll get really in depth about story and what he's going through in his life and, you know, all these different things. And then he'll say, go ahead, go away and write me something based off of these conversations that we have. And maybe he'll include some, you know, some artwork of the city and the different stages of the city as it's going through the different phases. And like all these things. But remember, like none of this has to do with picture. It's all just about story and talking. And it's great. Like, you know, when, you know, John Williams was working on Star Wars, it's not like in 1977, it's not like he opened up a QuickTime video and put it in his timeline and started writing, right? I mean, it's more of a, you know, he probably sat with, you know, Lucas and they talked about the story and the characters and the force and the different themes and all these things. And it's a very similar process because they just didn't have the technology back then like we do today to just sit down and throw a QuickTime in a timeline and start putting in markers and you know, mapping out hit points. You had to really kind of come at these scores from a story approach. And I think it shows in the music, you know, I mean, it's why John Williams' themes are just so amazing. I mean, you can tell he just absorbs those characters with music and really defines them with music. And then, you know, it's the same thing kind of like what we did with the video game stuff. We aren't writing anything to visuals. We're just kind of doing it all from conversations and imagination. So what we do is we define all these themes and we define, you know, we'll write a 5 to 10 minute long Peter Parker suite. And in that, there'll be different instrumentation ideas, different motifs, different, you know, ostinatos, rhythm ideas, all these different things. And they're like around 10 minutes long. And then I'll present that to Brian and say, hey, after a conversation, this is kind of what I thought of for Peter Parker. And then we listen to that and we say like, oh man, you know, like, minute 2 to 3 is perfect. You know, this sounds like exactly what I would think it is, but I don't know. This minute's like 5 to 7 are a little weird. I don't see it kind of fitting in my world. You know, and so like you kind of like, you have to kind of figure out what doesn't work before you figure out what works, you know? And then once I kind of isolate down some of these ideas and these things that he likes, then I'll start getting more into the nitty gritty of getting it against picture, getting it against, you know, gameplay, seeing how it works and how it kind of all comes together. I mean, and sometimes it's magic and it works perfectly. Like other times, you know, I remember when I was working on Maze Runner with Wes, like Wes is a huge John Williams fan. I'm a huge John Williams fan. He loved Jurassic Park. And he was like, oh, you know, we got these, you know, big walls out in the wilderness. These kids don't know what's outside of the walls. And, you know, we can like replace the walls with like Jurassic Park would sound like incredible in this and blah, blah. And we were like thinking of all these ideas of like how great that would sound. But then I remember like I wrote the initial suite for Maze Runner, and he like loved the main title part of it. But then I like went into this kind of like John Williams, fantastical Jurassic Park vibe, and it just didn't work. You know what I mean? So like sometimes you think something's going to work really well, but it just didn't have the mystery. Mm-hmm. It didn't have any of the edginess that we kind of needed, I think, for some of those characters in the original Maze Runner. And it just wasn't the right vibe. And so like sometimes you think you have the greatest idea in the world and you kind of go through these, the suite development. And then you realize like, oh, once you put it up against frames, it takes on a kind of a different attitude and a different meaning. So, but again, it's like, it's kind of an old school approach to how they used to score films. Cause like I said, they just didn't have the technology like we have today to be able to, you know, it's so, I see a lot of young composers these days and they like get picture and like throw it in their timeline and start working out ideas against picture. And I think like working against picture, I think is like one of the worst places for theme development, just because, you know, you have to be conscious of so many things happening with picture. You know, there's dialogue, there's sound effects, it's just not a great experimenting grounds for musical ideas, you know, like it's very hard. It's very easy to get functional with film music when you're writing the picture versus musical, you know? So I always like starting away from picture and then trying to, you know, reverse engineer it into picture after I come up with my character themes and different ideas from like a holistic. It's also easy to compartmentalize scores when you write it that way, you know, I'm going to write one on one. It's this scene, right? Because that's the way we organize our sessions. You know, you open up a Cubase session just from a technical standpoint. And you say like, oh, this is going to be one on one. And you start writing for that sequence, you know, and oh, this is one on two. And you open up a new session for that sequence. So you can compartmentalize the score and you lose kind of the big picture approach to things. So I like working in these suites where you kind of have, you know, you're writing a symphony for the movie, you know, you aren't writing for scenes, you're writing for the movie, you know, or you're writing for the game. And sometimes these big suites kind of have, you know, they blend themselves better to kind of a more of a holistic approach to the score.
You didn't just write music for any video game, right? It's kind of interesting. You had to write the theme for a very recognizable character that had multiple iterations of its theme, right? Like you have Danny Elfman, you got Michael Giacchino, you got Hans Zimmer. Yeah. I mean, I love all of it, but Ravi knows I'm such a big fan of the dun, 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 dun,
yeah.
Dun, 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 dun. So congrats to you. You may have the best Spider-Man theme that's ever been written.
I mean, it's, you know, when you have guys like that, you know, who've written all those great, I mean, you know, I listen to some of Chris Young stuff for the third one. I'm just like, oh
yeah,
my God,
yeah.
Like, the Sandman stuff's incredible. You know,
talked about that.
There's so many great iterations of the Spider-Man stuff. And they're all kind of different movies and different properties. And it's funny with our Spider-Man, that's like the way I originally got kind of introduced to the game and the way I had been trying for years to get into video game music. I just couldn't break it. Like I just couldn't. I begged and begged please find me a video game. Cause I'm a huge gamer. I've been a gamer my whole life. And I've always just wanted to kind of get into it and just be part of that world. And I had the hardest time, but Daredevil actually, believe it or not, out of all things, it's funny. I just scored like, you know, series and movies before I was able to even consider for video games.
Have you played through Spider-Man?
Yeah.
It's unbelievable.
It's a fun game. So the, So Brian, the, you know, Itahar, the, our director for Spider-Man, was a big Daredevil fan, and he was had this concept of Peter Parker. And he's like, you know, Peter, he's a little bit older in this game. He's kind of, you know, he's almost like a disgruntled superhero. You know, he's a little, he's aged up a little bit. He's a little bit more edgy. And like, he had this whole idea that he wanted to make Spider-Man kind of like a darker character, you know? And he's like, oh, Daredevil, you know? And like, we had this like whole concept. And then we started, I think he started talking to Marvel about it. And Marvel's like, well, you want to do what to Spider-Man? Like, you're crazy. You know what I mean? So not that they want us like completely get rid of it, but like, it was funny how it started off. I originally got hired because they were looking for kind of a darker, less Spider-Man type sound, but we ended up kind of in the Spider-Man universe for sure. You know, but there's definitely, you know, I mean, like a little bit of, I think a little bit of that, you know, DNA made it into it to a degree. It's not as, you know, bright and shiny as like, you know, Michael's stuff for the film, like his Spider-Man stuff's really cool, but it's definitely like, it's more fun. You know what I mean? Like my stuff's more, my stuff's dramatic.
Well, and that Spider-Man's younger than this one.
Yeah, right. You know, and so there's just like more of a, like, I think the video game score, it has just more drama to it. It's just a little bit more, you know, it's not as tongue in cheek. We have moments where it's fun, but for the most part, I think it's got a little bit more, it leans a little bit more into the drama than I think some of the other iterations was. Danny Elfman's was very dramatic. I remember his being kind of like very dramatic too. And I mean, yeah, there's just been great scores for Spider-Man, and I mean Marvel in general. You know, it's funny, Marvel, people always used to bag on Marvel. I remember being about like, I remember it was like, oh, they don't have any themes. I always think like, I'm like, God, Marvel's got, I think, like some of the stronger themes out there, which is interesting.
Yeah.
And it's improved a lot. It's improved.
Yeah. I mean, maybe like the old days, but I mean, Silvestri's, it's funny. One of the projects I worked on over the summer is I did all the music for the Avengers campus at Disneyland.
Oh, did you?
Really? Yeah. Yeah. And it was fun. Like, it made me really appreciate like all of those scores, you know, like Ant-Man and Chris Beck's.
Oh, Christoph Beck, let's go.
Yeah. You know, and I mean, listen, like Guardians, great stuff. I mean, but you really, and Spider-Man, and it was funny, like doing working on that project and then working with like Giacchino stuff. I'd be like halfway through like a motif and all of a sudden I'd be writing my Spider-Man thing and being like, oh shit, I can't do that. But it really made me like appreciate how great, you know, some of those scenes. I mean, you know, Alan Silvestri's stuff for Avengers is just incredible. Oh, yeah. And he's like a hero of mine. So yeah. So, I mean, it's, you know, they have a rich musical history when it comes to scores and stuff. So, it's been a blast to just be able to kind of, I mean, listen, like we all grew up on this stuff, you know what I mean?
Right.
So it's so fun to like work on these properties. And, you know, you're like a little kid reading this stuff when I was younger, you know? So I've always, it's definitely a dream gig for sure.
Two little random questions that, a very small portion of our listeners will appreciate, but I think they'll appreciate it so much that they're worth asking. One, did you ever find yourself consulting the music from the 90s animated Spider-Man series as you were kind of thinking through ideas?
Not really, but I do know that stuff. You know, honestly, with Spider-Man, it was so hard. It's so easy to listen to something like when you're working on a project, like consult stuff like that. And then you just end up, there was one, I remember I did one suite. I'd have to ask Scott Hanna, who is kind of like my creative lead over at Sony, and he's probably got better stories about it. But there are times definitely where like I would write a cue and all of a sudden he'd be like, this is Michael's stuff from Spider-Man, you know? And I'd be like, what, really? Like, I'd be like, no way, you know? And like,
Too much consulting can mess you up,
probably. Yeah, and honestly, it's a language, you know what I mean? Like, it's like when you're writing for comic book stuff like this, the audience is kind of expecting something, and I'm always like, I always feel like I'm an audience member before I'm even a composer, you know? So like, there's just an inherent sound that kind of comes along with these properties, and it's really hard to really upend it. You know what I mean? And say like, hey, look, like Joker is incredible because they kind of took something and they said, you know what, we're going to like totally turn this thing on its head and make it something completely new. You know what I mean? I mean, it's a different animal, obviously, than Spider-Man, but still, like, you can do it, you know, but it's a bold move to do it. And I don't think PlayStation was in the business of like us trying to completely reinvent the wheel, but they definitely wanted, it's easier to almost make it your own by reinventing the wheel than it is to make it your own, but kind of staying within the realm of
right
where we are with the superhero music. So I think that's what makes the job. And listen, I'm working on Spider-Man 2 right now.
I'm so glad to hear you say that.
It's harder. I don't think I spoiled anything. I think they've announced it.
Email me the files, please. Thank you.
Yeah. But it's harder like reinventing your own stuff. You know what I mean? Like, I gotta because you don't just want to regurgitate what you did for the first game too. You know what I mean?
Right.
There's new characters and new things going on in it. So there's definitely opportunities to do a lot of new stuff. But at the same time too, it's like, you can't just like every time Peter's swinging around the city, you can't just like fall into like, you know, there's so much traversal music in these games where you spend so much time swinging around that you can't just like be blasting people again with like what you did on Spider-Man 1, because it will just kind of feel... So, you know, it's a challenge to try to like reinvent this stuff constantly.
Well, and that's actually a perfect transition into Miles, because that was a similar game, but you didn't have to reinvent it, but you had to come up with a new set of themes for Miles. And I thought you did an incredible job with that too. So,
yeah.
Like, how did you intentionally make that one different? I know the beats, right? Like the lo-fi hip-hop beats make that soundtrack so incredible. But also, as a side note, it's the first game I remember on PlayStation 5 that didn't have load times. So the music fits perfectly into that, though, because like out of one scene, you go right into the next scene and you'll drop that beat, and it just flows so seamlessly.
Yeah, I mean, that's a lot of credit to the guys who, like, that's the one thing we were talking about, the process between writing music for film and episodic material versus writing for video games. There's such an interactive component to it that I have honestly nothing really to do with. But, like, it's amazing how the guys over at Insomniac and Sony will take, you know, we create music in a very technical way that allows, I call it like vertical, you know, you think vertically versus horizontally when you write video game music. So you're able to, you know, give them the material they need in order to, you know, like, think about it. Like, how many hours do you play Spider-Man for? It's like
40. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, 40, 50 hours, you know, playing that game. And like, and then you're doing like all the stuff after you play the Golden Path, you know what I mean? And like, so like, they need to take this music that we, like, listen, I wish they hired me to write, you know, 700 minutes of music, but they don't, you know, like, I mean, we're still creating like 300 minutes of music, but they still have to like take that amount of music and they have to stretch it out over long periods of time. And it's, they do such a good job on Spider-Man of like making it feel like it's not just looping all the time. You know what I mean? Like, so it's very dynamic. And like, so we work really hard on trying to compose vertically. And like, we have like little tricks to try to figure out a way where they can take a 10 minute long piece of music and stretch it out and give it variety over a 30 minute gameplay, you know? So, but they just do a really, really good job. And I think with PlayStation 5 and kind of how you lose loading times and, you know, it creatively, it just keeps opening up the world to even being a smoother and more of a cinematic experience, but it definitely makes it, you know, it's like one more thing we have to kind of, you know, be conscious about, because sometimes you would be able to use some of those loading times to kind of reset your audience a little bit to get into something. But now it's just like one continuous run, you know what I mean? So, which is great for the player, but as a composer and for the technical side of it, it just gives us like another, you know, and the technology is always moving faster than like kind of like the production process. So we're constantly trying to like find ways to like maintain a musical approach, but at the same time, like dealing with the fact that there's a player on the other end of the controller, you know, moving left or moving right or deciding whether to go down this path or deciding whether to go down that path, and how is the music gonna, you know, move with them and be a cinematic. And they do a great job. It's almost like the player is controlling the music, because it's never, you know, the player does one thing, another thing will kick in, and it's almost like, oh wait, I was playing the game and I was like, is this one of my cues? And I'd be like, oh yeah, it is. But like, I didn't have this trumpet line with this section, but shit, it works. You know what I mean? So like, you kind of
that's
like,
cool.
It's amazing. Like, so when you're playing the game as a player, you probably don't realize this, but you're basically creating that score by what you're doing on screen, you know? So they really, and we have to like work hard on making sure that our music, so you could lift a trumpet line and plop it into a middle of a section and say like, okay, this is going to work. You know, we're very conscious of tempos, very conscious of key, relative major and minors, making sure things play nice with each other on some of these long traversal suites. And there's a lot of like planning and thought that goes into it. Now, when you're writing for film, it's just linear. You know what I mean? Like you're just, you know, the scene's going to start here, you know, it's going to end there, and you got to hit A, B, C, and D. But when you're writing for games, you just don't know what's going to happen. And so you kind of have to have a lot of different approaches to deal with that.
Well, my other niche question that I was going to ask fits perfectly here. You're talking about kind of reinventing the wheel and changing things up from Spider-Man game to Spider-Man game. This is going to sound so silly, but I find myself curious when they changed the look of Peter Parker in the remaster version and in the Miles Morales game. You know, that was kind of a big stir in the fan community. Was that something that was sort of weird for you as you were kind of like, had you grown to associate these?
You know, it's funny. Remember how we talked about like how I'm writing on these things with that visually, like almost not even seeing some of them sometimes. It's like, I was like, so that to a degree kind of, I wasn't as influenced by it as much as maybe I probably would have been if it was a film situation. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like if it's a film situation and I was working on, you know, I got through my themes and my made ideas and then I was like applying it to the film, it probably would have definitely jolted me a little bit more. But because I was so story-based and I was so working from it kind of from like a suite standpoint in the very beginning, we do like, so games are kind of broken up into, you have gameplay and then you have cinematics. And the cinematics are more traditional. They're more kind of like cutscenes, you know what I mean? Right. Where you kind of like go into like, you know, they're definitely blurring the line now with next gen stuff, but it definitely like, you would definitely like go from playing and then all of a sudden you're kind of like in Peter's apartment and it seems like you're watching a film. You know what I mean? So like with that type of stuff, there definitely was like a little bit of an adjustment to it. But here's the thing too, like, you know, everyone thought it was like, oh, this is like modeled after Tom Holland, but it really wasn't. I think it was modeled after Yuri, the guy who plays.
Right.
Yeah.
And so like, I kind of like knew it going into it. Like that was the case. They just happened to look very similar to each other.
Yeah, they do.
Right.
Yeah. Right. So, but yeah, I mean, I definitely remember like when that happened and when it went down, but I wasn't as in the weeds with it as maybe some of the fan base was.
So
that makes sense.
John, let me get you out here with these three things. Rapid fire. Okay. Three comments. I feel like between Daredevil, Miles Morales and Spider-Man PS4, the John Pizzino sound that you're a king of right now is these fast arpeggiated strings with the slow epic horns. And it's my favorite thing ever. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, for sure. I think it's always been like, I've always been a huge Hans Zimmer fan. You know, I've also been a big John Williams fan and James Newton Howard fan. I was listening to film scores before I was even doing this. You know what I mean? So I've always been a film score junkie since I was a little kid. I mean, I saw the movie Empire of the Sun when I was 9 years old and I was like, boom, this is what I want to do. Like reverse engineered my way into this business. But I think so. There's something about fast moving lines over slow. I did it for Maze Runner too. And that's why I love scores like Interstellar Hans does such a great job of like creating that epicness without it being sleepy. You know what I mean? Like there's always just like a perpetual kind of motion going on. And it just lends itself really well, I think, to these properties that I'm that I'm kind of working on, you know? I mean, listen, I also love like Tom Newman's like one of my favorite composers of all time. And it's like the exact opposite style, you know what I mean? So there's definitely a lot of the DNA of, I always find like a lot of my influences, just like probably many artists, like you can hear all of it in a lot of the music that I do. It's just, it's almost impossible for it not to, you know, hear those influences in the music. But I would say that's a safe observation for sure.
Secondly, I'm here in Nashville. And did I see that some of the stuff you record is at Ocean Way in Nashville?
Yeah, we do. We did a bunch of stuff for Spider-Man. We did Mass Effect. I think we did all of Mass Effect Andromeda in Nashville.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, we did.
If you're scoring Spider-Man 2 in Nashville, please text me. Like,
I will, for sure. Ocean
Way and watch it.
100%. I will definitely. Oh.
Yeah, I went to Belmont.
Nice.
I know. Yeah. So we have classes in Ocean Way back in the day.
Yeah.
Like 10 years ago. So it's really cool for me to see that on video. The third thing is, what do I need to do? What strings do I need to pull to get John Pisano composing an MCU film? Like, how do
preferably I go a Daredevil one?
Hey, listen, yeah. I'm ready. I'm telling you. I just it's up to the Marvel gods. You know.
I'll talk to Kevin.
Yeah, please. No. I mean, I would love to. I think, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, like a lot of the directors that come into these films kind of have their teams together. And so you kind of always have to wait for that opportunity to where somebody comes in and they want to try something new or, you know, like they're fans of stuff we did in the past and stuff. But yeah, no, I mean, I'm definitely, I'm waiting for that call just as much as you are.
You're on the Friends from Work radar. That's
for okay. Sure. Good.
Yes. And good. In the meantime, I know you're working on the Spider-Man 2 game. Is there what projects do you have going currently, or things that are going to be releasing soon that folks can be on the lookout for?
Yeah, I'm working on a second Diary of a Wimpy Kid. I'm working on Night at the Museum for Disney, nice. Which is an animated film. So yeah, I mean, and then there's some other things that I can't really talk about because I'm under doing. But yeah, no, there's some big projects in store as well too that you'll be able to hear about soon. So yeah, no, there's a lot of stuff. We're busy.
Yeah, well, that makes us happy, and it makes our listeners happy because we've got a lot of John Pisano fans and the Friends from Work crew.
Nice.
Thanks so much, John. We seriously can't wait to see what you have in store. We are massive fans, and we appreciate your time here on this podcast.
No, thank you. Had a blast.
Man, I could not have been more happy with that conversation. John was so fun to talk to. And it's just, we talk about this all the time, and I don't want it to sound like we're disingenuous just because we say it all the time, but I feel like we've been really blessed with the kind of folks that have come onto the show and how passionate they are and how much they just enjoy talking about the work and the stories and they really care about the characters.
I love that he's a gamer himself too. That's a fun tidbit.
I know.
What would that be like to be playing through Spider-Man being like, oh, that's my music. That's pretty fun.
Right. I also thought about this and I didn't want to bring it up lest we kind of force him into spoilery territory, but he talked about how he was hired to do the Spider-Man game in large part because of what he brought to Daredevil, which is a pretty, you know, like a dramatic, dark, kind of mysterious, broody score that, by the way, really sets the tone for that show. And he came over and says he initially tried that, and then they went with something obviously kind of more triumphant and Spider-Man-y. But I wonder, you know, folks that are keeping track of the Spider-Man game story, I feel like we're in, well, and they've actually said this, right? The developers have said the second game is going to be a good bit darker than the first one. So I kept wondering, like, I wonder if he's going to be able to bring back some of that stuff that he had initially brought to the table however many years ago for the first game.
Yeah. You know, I think it's only a matter of time. I'm not kidding. Till he's going to be involved in the MCU in some way. Like, whether it's Daredevil season 4 or Daredevil in a movie or, dude, it's only a matter of time. It's going to happen.
Now I want to go to the Avengers campus and hear his remixes of all these MCU themes.
Which we
That's
will.
So dope.
Friends from Work is still going to do a live episode from the Avengers campus at some point in our lives. It's going to happen. And then the last thing I need to say about John, off air, there might be a fun little connection going here. I don't know. Just stay tuned. We talked about a few fun things off air with him too. So I'm really excited about that. If you want to hear John's work and you don't play video games, check out Daredevil all three seasons on Spotify. And as Robbie said, check out the Defenders soundtrack on Spotify. The show itself isn't unbelievable, but the music's pretty dope. You're going to like it.
It is.
And I think it's time to get well-versed in John's music because, like I said, I think it's coming to the MCU. Thank you guys so much for listening. As always, you can follow us on social media at the FFW Podcast. Reach out to us on there. We try to do our best to respond to all comments and questions, and we love hearing from you guys. But you can also check out our website, theffwpodcast.com. On that website are a bunch of important links to our merch shop, to a donate section if you want to donate to the podcast, but also to join our Slack or to join Friends From Work Plus if you want even more goodness of Friends From Work in your life.
So if you are intrigued by this to watch Daredevil and you haven't yet and you want to hear our coverage, that's on Friends From Work Plus, as well as all the movie club stuff that we've talked about with Kyle, as well as a bunch of comics episodes, including some Daredevil stuff and coming soon, some Moon Knight stuff. So I think we're between everything, running the gamut here.
And as we said, the ramp up has officially begun and we want you guys on board. Spread the word about Friends From Work to your friends and get everybody ready because next week we have a preview of Moon Knight coming. And then the following week we are diving headfirst into weekly coverage of that show as well as Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness. It's going to be quite the ride, and we can't wait to do it with all of you out there. And so, thank you so much, and we'll see you next time on Friends From Work.
Live on DAZN Worldwide, May 2nd and 3rd, Garcia versus Romero and Canelo versus Skull. Friday from 6 p.m. Eastern, Garcia returns in a history-making Times Square takeover. 24 hours later, Saturday from 7 p.m. Eastern, King Canelo faces undefeated Skull for the undisputed crown. May 2nd and 3rd, a knockout weekend of boxing. Pick one or go all in for only $90, exclusively on DAZN. Buy now at DAZN.com/boxing.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.